You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome back, everybody, and happy Friday afternoon. Hope you all are doing well. We got a great guest coming up in just a few moments, but I wanted to give some of our amazing listeners an opportunity to finish our thoughts from the last discussion over the past hour. There was a very interesting article that was published today in the Washington Post. Its title is this: The Secretive Donor Circle That Lifted J.D. Vance Is Now Rewriting MAGA's Future. It talks about a donor named Chris Buskirk. And in essence, we're going to share that article in our show notes for today. You can always find those at civicmedia.us/shows. Just look for my show. Go to today's show. You'll find all the supporting info. What Buskirk, Peter Thiel, J.D. Vance, and this group, this very elite group of MAGA operatives want to see is a new American aristocracy. They don't like to use the word oligarch, but they literally are embracing this idea of an American aristocracy where that aristocracy is presumably benevolent, I guess, and is the one that it's that group, this very, very small elite group of aristocrats that basically control government and decide how America is run. That's what they want to see. And so there is a through line between what I'm going to talk about with my next guest and what the entirety of our prior conversation was about. And that is by basically over the last 50 years, fundamentally changing our system of taxation that was supercharged by the Supreme Court saying money is speech and corporations are people. They're not, and money isn't speech. But by doing that, what we've seen is one of the greatest transfers, if not the greatest transfer of wealth over the last 50 years from the middle class to the ultra, ultra elites. And now, with Mr. Buskirk, Mr. Vance, Peter Thiel, and others, you see what is the political system, the fruition of that massive transfer of wealth. They say, oh, well, no, those working stiffs, they really shouldn't decide how our government is run. Pretty scary. And that is being systematized and legitimized by the Supreme Court failing to protect the franchise, our access to the voting booth. I'm going to introduce my guest in just a moment, but I want to get a couple of our callers in. Sherry from Horicon, welcome to the show. What you got for us this Maggie, afternoon?
Maggie, my friend. Okay, so I was on Medicaid, and a lot was covered. I had like $230 for food share, and then I turned 65, so now I'm on Medicare. And now I like Social Security is like $780 a month. And then my food share went down to like $80 a month after Trump. And I don't know how they expect people to live, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm struggling. So it's, you know. Groceries aren't going down, gas isn't going down, nothing's going down. Oh, golly gee whiz. So
except for your benefits. Except for your benefits. Things get more expensive.
My benefits went down. At the beginning, my Social Security was like a little over $1,000. He came into office and it's like 700 and something. You know, it.
Because Sherry had that to spare. Are you kidding me? Sorry, Sherry, we want to squeeze a couple more callers in before we get to our guest. Joe from Madison, if you can, be brief, but welcome back.
I just want to say in response to Sherry, call again. I think people need to understand how brutal and how tough it is where you are. And your willingness to share that information is absolutely crucial, and we really, really appreciate it. And I feel incredibly upset that you're going through this stuff. I don't know, maybe Maggie, you can speak to this. I was under the impression that Governor Evers did something where he basically supplied money into the EBT cards. Do you know if Sherry might be affected by something like that? Are you aware of this situation?
Yeah, Evers, from accounts that we've been trying to verify all day here at Civic Media, people's food share cards should be fully funded as of this morning. That is what Evers did overnight. It's interesting. Government can certainly move fast when it wants to. And again, kudos to Governor Evers for doing that. And I echo Joe's sentiments. Thank you. Thank you to Sherry for sharing her story. You want to do that? You've got a story to share? We matter at civicmedia.us. We matter at civicmedia.us. Mike from Muscadet, what you got for us this afternoon?
Oh, you got Muscadet right. I appreciate that. Finally, Maggie. You got that?
You're welcome,
now.
Sir. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, if in the future you could bring up a guest or just get on this topic, is how do politicians or Senate, Congress, how do they go into office, like Barack Obama take, for instance? How do they go in as just simple people, just common people that come out multimillionaires?
It's a great question, Mike. I'll do it this week. I'm going to find a block to do that. Maybe my senior producer, Jamie, can find me a block in my week, Mike, before the end of the show so I can tell you when I'm going to talk about this. Barack Obama made his millions after he exited the White House, largely from speaking engagements, writing books, etc. The problem, Mike, that you're speaking to, and this is a problem on both the Democratic side and the Republican side, is that Congress has refused to effectively ban themselves from owning stock in companies that they oversee in their committee assignments. So there's a huge insider trading problem, I would say. They do not require blind trusts for Congress people. There's a whole number of system reforms, Mike. And again, this has been a problem on both the Democratic and Republican side. Barack Obama making millions of dollars from giving speeches and writing books after he's president doesn't really bother me. Congress people that stay in Congress for 40 years and have access to sensitive inside information, and we do not have a regulatory system that prevents them from trading to their benefit on that inside information, that bothers me. I'll tell you what else bothers me. A president whose personal net worth has increased by $2 billion since he took office, who refused to put his assets into a blind trust and is now cutting deals in very obvious pay-to-play circumstances, that bothers me. Barack Obama did divest himself and did put all of his personal investments into a blind trust. He never touched any of it. And his net worth, if you track it over the course of his presidency, did not move substantially at all. Not worried about Barack, deeply worried about Trump. And if we want to talk about Barack Obama and Democrats who appear to have benefited from being in public office, then you've got to be honest about what Donald Trump is doing, which is completely an aberration, and we have never seen anything like the explosion in wealth for the Trump organization and Donald Trump personally as we have in this second Trump administration. It is without historical precedent. And those laws need to be strengthened as well. Every elected official, in my opinion, Republican, Democrat, independent, purple, polka-dotted people eater, they should all be accountable, and we should have very strong laws that prevent profiteering off holding public office, as well as term limits. Thank you for the question, Mike. We are going to have time, not today, Jamie, but later this week, hopefully. And Mike, I will make sure that I tell you when I'm going to talk about this, because I want to talk about those system reforms in great detail. With that, folks, let's talk about the franchise. Let's talk about what has been going on with the Supreme Court and ensuring that each and every one of us that have the right to vote actually get to exercise that vote, and that vote matters. That is incredibly important. With that, I want to introduce Professor Stephen Wright. He is a clinical professor at UW Law School, my alma mater, if you've been listening to this show for a while. He has graduated from Duke, Johns Hopkins, and, of course, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he eventually got his JD at WashU in St. Louis. He has more degrees than I have fingers on a hand, basically. Welcome to the program, Professor Wright. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Very briefly, what is the Voting Rights Act? How did it come about? And what wrong did it seek to redress?
Sure. The Voting Rights Act, for a very long time, was known as the greatest piece of American legislation in all of American history. The idea was it attempted to eradicate all forms of racial discrimination in voting, primarily in the South, but there was also prevalent cases of discrimination against Native Americans and Latinos throughout the country. But it was the centerpiece of President Johnson's effort to bring about a more equal society. And it did so by eliminating things like the discriminatory placement of polling places, of unfair registration practices, of old school tests that made like grandfather clauses and reading tests. And so it really was the greatest opportunity for Congress and the federal government to fulfill the promise of citizenship and the opportunity to participate in our democracy fully for people of color.
It's incredibly important, and you know quite a bit about it. You, of course, were also a litigator with the voting section of the U.S. Department of Justice, which has basically been nearly entirely gutted under this administration, which speaks to what the priorities are for this administration when it comes to voting. Tell us a little bit about what the Supreme Court did a few years ago about what they call the pre-certification requirement that came under the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court basically invalidated a key portion of the Voting Rights Act. What was it? What is pre-certification and why does it matter?
Yeah, so part of the challenge of desegregating the United States, and in particular the South, is an individual would bring a lawsuit, and then they would win the lawsuit, but the South or the Southern jurisdiction would find a sort of slippery way around it. And so what the government did in Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 did was created a mechanism where if any Southern state or states that had a extreme history of discrimination decided to make any type of voting change, they had to get pre-clearance or pre-certification from the federal government. And about 10 years ago, despite the court acknowledging that this was one of the most transformative aspects of the Voting Rights Act, they decided that it was no longer appropriate and eliminated the pre-clearance requirement. Since then, several studies have shown almost conclusively that there's been a lot of fallback, that polling places in African-American neighborhoods have decreased, the bus rides that take that people without cars need to take to get to the polls have decreased. Voting rolls and voting opportunities in many communities have essentially gone away.
Yeah, here in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, we've had souls to the polls for a long time. That was the beginning of the Supreme Court's attack on the Voting Rights Act. The logic of the Voting Rights Act is now about to be turned on its head, on its ear, whatever metaphor you want to use. We're going to talk specifically with Professor Wright on the other side about the threat that Louisiana v. Calais poses and why it matters to every voter, regardless of political preference, and regardless if you happen to be a black or brown folk or white folk or any kind of folk. Access to the franchise matters to hold the wealthy accountable and to make sure government works for the vast majority of us. Stay tuned. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm joined for the remainder of this half hour by Professor Stephen Wright, a clinical professor at the UW Law School. He's a former trial attorney in the voting section of the US DOJ. He litigated enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the National Voter Registration Act, and the Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Stephen, you and I were talking in the break. I just want to share this tidbit because there was a listener question earlier about corruption and how elected officials seem to get very wealthy while they're in office, which seems to not square with how we intuitively think about what public service should be. And you pointed out, and I need to say it again, the Supreme Court has taken the teeth out of a lot of our anti-corruption laws over the last 10 to 15 years, perhaps from the last term. The most notable one of those was an explicit pay-to-play that occurred in a local government the payment to the elected official was given after the contract was awarded, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, that's not corruption. That's just a tip. That's a gratuity for job well done. So, folks, if you want to corrupt your elected official, just be sure you give them the money after they do the thing that you're asking them to do, not before. And all's well that ends well. That is a topic for a whole nother day. And Mike from Muscadet, I am going to do that Tuesday starting at 5:30. I'm going to be talking about system reforms to try to take the rot out of government. The first thing is to deal with money in politics, and I'll talk a little bit about the Montana Project on Tuesday afternoon at 5:30. Mike, I hope you join me then. But Professor Wright, let's talk about Louisiana v. Calais. What's at risk here? This has been argued and briefed. It's before the Supreme Court. And what do we think is going to happen here? It's a pretty scary moment.
Yeah, so one of the things that was a effect of the success of the Voting Rights Act is that discrimination became much more sophisticated. It wasn't okay to use the N-word anymore. It wasn't okay to close down polling places. And so what some southern jurisdictions in particular started to do was to draw their maps in a way as to dilute the votes of African Americans. And it wasn't limited just to the South, but primarily the South was the focus and the epicenter of the efforts to disenfranchise through dilution. So if you could draw a district that included a Black community where the Black community might get someone elected, those jurisdictions would specifically divide it up into pieces in order to make sure that didn't happen. And so in around 1980, both the courts and Congress recognized that this was a problem, and they created a mechanism under the Voting Rights Act, a portion of Section 2 specifically aimed at preventing this type of discriminatory vote dilution. And that law basically says if you're in a state, in a community, where race still very much determines your life, where it defines your experience as an American, where the Black community votes for one person and the white community votes for another, in those extreme cases where there's racial disparities, where there's a history of discrimination, where, you know, a federal court must find that, you know, that racism and race still matter a great deal in that community, then if you can draw a majority-minority district, then you presumptively should. And so that's what happened in Louisiana. Louisiana satisfied all of those criteria, but they only drew a map in New York that created one Black district out of six, even though African Americans make up roughly a third of Louisiana's population. And so Black voters challenged that. The federal court agreed that ultimately they should get another majority Black district, but eventually that decision was challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it ended up taking a sort of roundabout way, but ultimately the Supreme Court on its own decided it was going to ask, is this idea even constitutional? Can you force a jurisdiction in these communities with a history of racism where race still very much defines your experience? Can you force them to draw a majority-minority district? You know, for many of us, once again, we had thought that was sort of settled law, but the Roberts Court is obviously quite willing to change these type of things. And so, once again, we're having a discussion about the role of race plays in our politics and in the experience of each individual American.
It's stunning to me because you can look at these map drawing exercises. Louisiana is an extraordinary one when you look at the demography based on race. Black and brown folks in Louisiana, over 30% of the population. When Louisiana decided to draw their congressional maps, they had 1/6 of the seats, or 16% of the seats. So you've basically, if you, and again, there are the, we don't need to get into the factors under, why am I forgetting the
jingles.
The jingles factors, we don't need to get into that. But if you think that, you know, overarchingly, Black and brown folks have preferred candidates 30% to 16%. You saw it in the gerrymandering in Wisconsin, where a majority of Wisconsinites, sometimes upwards of 60%, were voting for Democrats, but they had less than 30% of the seats. A halving of the voting power. Your vote has to have power in order to have meaning. It cannot be symbolic. That's what is so challenging and really dark about the Supreme Court's antipathy towards this provision, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And I'll note, and I'm going to credit listener Mark from Prairie du Sac for pointing this out, section, the power of Congress to legislate in this way was written into the 15th Amendment, the 24th Amendment, and the 26th Amendment, which are part of our Constitution. So, and even in the second sentence of the 19th Amendment, to enforce these amendments with law in the Constitution, the amendments themselves were granting Congress this very power that the Supreme Court now, with this newly constituted, I'm going to say somewhat illegitimate, weird slant, is about to strip away from Congress, weakening congressional power in one of the moments where we need Congress to stand up the most. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Professor Stephen Wright.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate
really appreciate your time and your insight. We'll have him back to talk more about this important case very soon, folks. Stay with me when we come back. We're going to lighten the mood a little bit with a Friday installment of Ask Maggie. Get your questions in now, 855-752-4842. Welcome, everybody. I feel like all the hard work has been done because now it's time for Ask Maggie on the Maggie Dolan Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Folks, every Friday we do this at 5:30. You can ask me basically anything you want. You can submit those questions anytime at askmaggie@civicmedia.us. That's an email address, askmaggie@civicmedia.us. You can always zip us questions via the text line, 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. And a big thanks to clinical professor Stephen Wright from the UW Law School. We're going to have him back really soon. I shouldn't say really soon. I think Stephen and I were talking during the break about looking into 2026 when it is expected that the Supreme Court is going to rule and invalidate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. What that means for folks, what redistricting will look like moving forward. We'll definitely have him back. I thank him mightily. Before we get into the fun stuff, a bit of breaking news. This, according to the New York Times, just within the last 20 minutes. A federal appeals court has denied a last-minute attempt by the Trump administration to halt food stamp funding during the government shutdown. You cannot make this stuff up. Of course, Trump, as I pointed out at the top of the show, appealed the federal district court's ruling late yesterday to fully fund SNAP benefits. The judge gave the Department of Justice and the Trump administration quite the lashing down. He could have just said, okay, I'll go do that now. I don't want any Americans not to have their food benefits. It's Thanksgiving. But no, Donald Trump decided to, of course, appeal that. And again, this afternoon, a federal appeals court, at least for the time being, has denied the bid of Donald Trump to keep food out of Americans' mouths. This, like happened in Wisconsin, has now opened the door for other states to fully fund the SNAP benefits. New York, Kansas, Pennsylvania, and Oregon are already queued up to do so. Wisconsin, God bless you. Uncle Tony. Governor Tony Evers getting it done for Wisconsinites. Got those payments out last night. Folks, if you receive food share, check your cards. They should be fully funded. If not, do contact the state and ask them to make sure that you're getting your card fully funded. There can be some small timing differentials. But some good news coming from the federal appeals court. Of course, he'll probably ask the Supreme Court to keep people hungry this Thanksgiving holiday. Who knows what'll happen there? With that, the news of the day largely completed as we roll into the weekend. Welcome back, senior producer and contributor extraordinaire, Jamie Martinson.
Sure.
Lovely to see you.
That's what we'll go with. Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it really is unbelievable, right? I mean, how many times, this is what I don't understand. How many times, it's a lesson that I used to, you know, kind of go through with my own kids. How many times do you have to be told no before you're just like, okay, I'm going to do the right thing? I will never forever understand.
Well, again, this is sort of like, think about what a temperamental 12-year-old boy would do, yeah, right? Like, I'm going to stomp my feet and have a temper tantrum. The other construct that I've come up with to, like, predict what the Trump administration could do is, like, think of a comic book villain and then fill in the blank.
It's like all the Marvel movies in one.
Are there no workhouses, right?
Oh, we can either go back to Charles Dickens references, Marvel. I mean, pick the century you want to live in, and we'll make it work. We'll make it work. But we do have some good questions today for this edition of Ask Maggie. And before, of course, we can get to those questions, just because it's one of my favorite parts.
Yes.
Let's run that intro there, Jacob, because we like to know what we're playing here today.
It's time to get your questions answered, Wisconsin style. Welcome to Ask Maggie, a rapid-fire round from politics to pop culture. So buckle up, Buttercup. It's Ask Maggie, and we're about to take your questions at lightning speed.
As we always say, not quite lightning speed, more like turtle pace, but it's fine. We have some good discussion in the process.
Well-intentioned.
That's right. We have all the intentions to do it in lightning speed, but it never happens that way. I think we're going to start with this one because it's a good kind of jumping off point from what we were just discussing. It actually comes to us from Sarah in Minocqua. And she asked this question. After Tuesday's election results and Schumer's proposal today to, you know, fund government, do you see the Democrats giving in to the GOP or standing strong during the shutdown? Do they have a mandate after Tuesday for their decision either way? I think that's a great question. So we're going to let you answer this. We'll give you 60 seconds on that one, Maggie. What do you think?
I was listening to Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor when he made this announcement, and I screamed at my TV, like, no, don't just do a year. However, I had to remind myself that this isn't just political theater, that all of this deeply matters. And when you are talking about these tough compromises, you have to give a little. And I think by proposing something that certain Republicans behind closed doors had already floated a few weeks ago, as I discussed at the top of the show, it's pretty good. It's a good compromise. It calls the Republican the MAGA bluff on, oh, we've got pages and pages and concepts of plans and all these ideas on how to fix healthcare. Great. You didn't want major reform during the debate over the continuing resolution. We're not going to ask for that. We're simply going to ask you to make sure that people can continue to access healthcare. We'll extend the subsidies for a single year, and then you guys can show us your magic pill of how to solve healthcare problems, since you've got pages and pages and concepts and ideas and whole binders full of ideas about healthcare for the last 16 years that no one has ever actually laid eyes on. So bluff called, I think, from, again, the shutdown is painful.
Yeah.
It's not good. Real people are suffering, and it is a real offer. It is showing that Democrats are willing to negotiate. And again, the Trump administration is a 12-year-old boy, right? It is not negotiating. It is not governance to simply say, give me what I want, or I'm going to continue to throw a temper tantrum, which, you know, you watch Trump sort of spinning out over these last few days. That's what's happening, right? Post-Tuesday, get rid of the filibuster.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
And let's be clear. I mean, there was obviously some Senate backlash to what Schumer had to say on the floor today. In fact, Roger Marshall, who is the great senator from Kansas, said it's a horrible idea when talking about the one-year extension of the ACA subsidies. We might as well go home and start over again. It's disappointing that they think this is what's going to open the government. Are you kidding me? I mean, we're talking about, for some people, let's be realistic, as people are starting to dive into the ACA and starting to re-up for another year, for some people, this is literally life and death. It's literally life and death, because this is what is getting them their medicines. It's what's keeping them alive, giving them access to affordable health care. And a horrible idea is what it's being called, you know? And I agree. I mean, 1 year, is it good enough? Probably not. There's probably a good chance if anybody accepts it, we're going to end up right back in this position. But at least it gives them the opening of government, and it allows them to go back to the negotiating table. And really, you have to think about it in terms of somewhat of what we saw here in the state of Wisconsin over the budget. Right?
Yes.
You talk about the give and the take of all of it. Not everybody's going to be happy at the end of it, but does it get government open? Does it get people back to work? Does it get some of these federal agencies open again? Then yeah, I think you do what you got to do at that point when you're talking about the American people. So I don't know, win-win situation, no-win situation. What do you think?
That's I mean, that's what a negotiation is. You're not going to get a perfect solution, or frankly, even anything close to it. If Republicans don't take this deal,
how long does this go on?
Then I think you take the offer off the table. What I think Schumer should have done is said, you have until Monday.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In negotiating, I often will put time limits on things and say, let's create some urgency here. Otherwise, we're not going to be doing that.
I'm just glad Tony Evers did the right thing yesterday. And,
yes.
I mean, come on now. We love Uncle Tony. Who doesn't love Tony Evers? He's fantastic.
He is.
He's not going to be this.
He's a good man doing a good job.
Yes.
And trying. I often say to people, you know what? My goal in life is to try hard and do good. Like, that's what that's the object. If I know that I gave my best effort and that I'm trying to do good and that I can affect a tiny bit of good and I tried my best, try hard, do good. It's not all that hard to do. I don't know that Donald Trump has ever really tried hard to do good. Just saying.
Yeah.
He'll try hard to get rich.
Sure. Wouldn't we all love that, though? I mean, you know, let's be realistic. We would all love that option.
$2 billion.
If I had the option of appearing in Macaulay Culkin movies back in the day and saying three lines, I would probably take my mill and run away, too. I have no idea what he made, by the way. All right. This is another really great question. And this one is a little lighter today in the subject matter. It comes to us from Lee in Lodi. And, you know, if you've been watching the forecast or listening to the forecast on your favorite civic media radio station, you will know that we are expecting areas of snow in some portions of the state. And so the question is this: with some areas expecting some of their first snow showers of the season this weekend, do you, and I love this question for you because I know you're a bit of a foodie, do you have a favorite cold weather meal that you like to cook, Maggie? Look at this. 1 minute for Jacob when you're ready.
Okay, so this would not have been my answer 2 days ago, but 2 days ago, I was looking at what I had in my pantry, and I was like, you know what I can do? I think I can make chicken divan in a crock pot with the rice, and it came out fabulously. So everybody listen up. You get your crock pot out. You grease the inside of it with butter, maybe a little nonstick. Put your cup of basmati white rice, favorite kind of rice, in the bottom. Spread it out. Put a little pat of butter on the rice. Put in at least double the amount of chicken stock to rice, okay? Then you cut up your fresh broccoli. Put that on top of the rice. Then you take your chicken breasts, skinless, boneless. Cut those puppies in half. I did three of them. Salt and pepper, maybe a little paprika if that's your thing. You put the chicken breasts on top of the broccoli, okay? And then you take your can of cream of chicken soup, because we're Wisconsinites and we use the Campbell's cream of chicken, that's and such, whatever. Cream of chicken, whatever you like. Cream of chicken, I use cream of chicken and cream of mushroom soup. A healthy dollop of mayonnaise, some lemon juice, and Dijon. Whisk that together. Pour it over the whole mess. Get it all over that. And then an entire bag of shredded cheese. Pop the lid on the crock pot. Turn that puppy on low. And in 3 to 4 hours, you're going to have fully cooked rice and a fully one-pot meal. It is perfect when it gets cold outside and it's snowing. And you basically, other than fresh broccoli, and you can use frozen, you probably have all the stuff to eat to make this in your house right now.
That
super
sounds amazing.
Easy.
Yeah. That sounds amazing. I have to tell you, I am the queen of crock pots. I really am. I have various sizes, and at any given time, you might see all of them on my counter preparing some sort of side dish or dip or main dish or something. I love my crock pots.
Slightly embarrassing. So not only do I have two different size crock pots, one for like the buffalo chicken dip to take, you know, that's small.
Sure.
The big one. I also have two commercial hot plates, big hot plates for when I'm doing full hot buffet at the house.
Of course.
You got to have both.
You got to do everything. Sometimes.
Obviously.
It's necessary.
That's going to do it for this Friday's cold weather edition, I guess, of Ask Maggie. We're going to be right back with Terry Barr. to lead us into the weekend with what's good, local, and overlooked in Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. We have made it through another week. And we all deserve congratulations for that. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Every Friday at this time, we are joined by my good friend and colleague at Civic Media, Terry Barr, for a little dose of what's good, local, and overlooked in Wisconsin. Before we do that, literally minutes ago, this update from the New York Times, the Trump administration has said that it filed an emergency application to stop the funding of full SNAP benefits. It filed that emergency application at the Supreme Court within the last half hour. Is somebody around who's going to be like, Mr. President, it might not be the best look after a judge tells you to just fund the SNAP benefits for you to go to court not once, but twice to basically say, I'd rather see Americans go hungry. We're going to fight this. It's ridiculous. Just pay the SNAP benefits. It's okay to be nice every once in a while. Terry, tell me something good. Literally, tell me something
every good. Once in a while. Yes, Maggie. Okay, I'm gonna dive right into this for you.
Please.
Because this story kind of surprised me. It's very, very overlooked. And you might say it was even lost to history. It's about Veterans Day, which is next Tuesday, and there's an important tie back to Wisconsin. So let me tell you, Harvey Higley is the man we're talking about. He devoted his entire life to service after the Marinette County man graduated from UW-Madison in 1915. So here's the rest of the story most people have never heard. He went and connected with President Eisenhower about something very important. And here's what I found out when I talked to Todd Pritchard from the Wisconsin Alumni Association about Harvey Higley's life.
He never forgot the men that he saw so bravely fight in World War I. So he really dedicated the rest of his life to helping those men and women and making sure that they weren't forgotten. He went on to become he was the commander of the American Legion in Wisconsin right at the beginning of World War II. He was part of the Eisenhower administration. He became the administrator of Veterans Affairs, became part of that administration in 1953. He took on that role right as World War II obviously had ended and the Korean War was still going on. So that was the time in American history where we had the most veterans to take care of. And unfortunately, there were a lot of financial issues going on in the country. We had just fought a major war. We're still in another war, right? And so he really fought hard to make sure that those veterans got the benefits that they were promised and that they deserved.
It doesn't end there, Maggie. He, during the Veterans Affairs Administration, as he served, he's the one that created the GI Bill. Veterans be able to further their education after service. And here's the Veterans Day tie-in. He persuaded President Eisenhower to change Armistice Day to Veterans Day, which would then be a national holiday. And the president signed it into law then in 1954. So this is the whole thing about trying to remember this man, Harvey Higley, again, from Marinette County in Wisconsin. He obviously made sure that everyone else through Veterans Day is being remembered. And when I found out about his history, I felt like I needed to share this so we remember him too.
Oh, that's amazing. And what a point of pride for Wisconsinites that this native Wisconsinite helped create the GI Bill. And that is amazing. It is timely. And, you know, it does relate to some of our broader conversations that we have here on this program. You know, the GI Bill was an incredibly powerful tool, especially after World War II, that helped build middle class wealth, right? That home ownership is such an essential key to building wealth. As most folks know, if you've looked at the GI Bill, while it was facially neutral in its language, it was applied in a way that it did not provide those benefits to Black World War II veterans. And that fact, coupled with the fact that most of the New Deal benefits, whether you're talking about Social Security or Medicaid, explicitly excluded jobs that were predominantly held by Black Americans at the time, those two things that much of the New Deal excluded by hook or crook Black Americans from the benefits of those New Deal policies, plus the fact that the GI Bill was implemented in a way that excluded Black veterans from those benefits, is part of why we see such an enormous racial wealth gap in this country amongst middle class folks. And again, it's one of those things that I was talking to a pretty famous news person here in Wisconsin, and she shared with me yesterday that one of her colleagues, also a pretty famous news person here in Wisconsin, did not know that the New Deal and the GI Bill were implemented in a way that basically kept those benefits from Black Americans. That was news to a newsman who has been doing this for 30 years in the state of Wisconsin. Yeah. And I'll just say this, that is why we need to teach actual history and not a whitewashed, sanitized version.
Absolutely.
Thereof.
One other good thing, Higley did move forward eventually and was able to open VA services to all African-American servicemen and women.
Thank you, Terry. We did not plan that. Thank you for bringing us a full and complete history and something that Wisconsinites can be very proud of. Thank you, Mr. Hinckley. Thank you, Terry Barr. Thank you for listening. Folks, remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it's always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.